Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Prem Divakar. Divakar took sannyas at his own request at the age of 10, and when he was 15, he left England with his family to live with Osho in Pune. Divakar is now an Osho Mystic Rose Senior Facilitator Trainer. I'm so happy to have Divakar on the show, and I hope you enjoy it. Divakar, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Soram. Great to speak to you.
Okay, so I normally start by asking guests how they've come across Osho. And in your case, it's slightly different. So I'd like to start by asking you about your decision to take sannyas when you were just 10 years old. How did that come about?
Okay, so just a little bit of background. As I know, you've done a podcast with my mother, Leela, so she may have told you a little bit about how she came to sannyas. But very briefly, when we arrived from South Africa to London, in 1972, due to Leela's ill health with asthma and allergies, she was directed towards Dr. Shyam Singha, who's an Indian naturopath, herbalist, and acupuncturist practitioner who lived in London. He gave her, you know, some treatment, but also suggested that she come and do this process called dynamic meditation, which she'd never heard of. She'd never meditated in her life, but she found herself walking down into Nirvana Meditation Center, not really sure what all this was about, she then tried doing this meditation for a couple of weeks. And anyway, so Shyam Singha had this guru in India, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and that's how our family came into contact through Shyam Singha. Leela took sannyas, much to her own surprise, in 1973. It just sort of came upon her too that she decided, you know, she was sitting in front of a picture of Bhagwan and something switched inside her and she decided to take sannyas. So she'd become a sannyasin. She changed her name from Lydia to Leela. I think it was in 1974. I think she went to Pune for 3 weeks. She went to India in 1974. She did a meditation camp, did a couple of groups, and she came back. I've always had a very strong connection to Leela. Me and her, we have a very strong bond and a very strong set of interests that we are both drawn to in terms of personal development and understanding the human condition. It's something we both have a deep interest in. And I noticed something about her that I found very, very relaxing when she came back from India. A lot of the stress, a lot of harshness had gone out of her energy, and this is as a 10-year-old. I didn't articulate this in my mind at the time, but I did feel the difference. And actually, it was just out of curiosity. I actually said to my mum, I said, "Can kids become sannyasins?" And she said, "I don't know." I said, "Would you find out?" She said, "All right, I'll find out." So she contacted Veena at Nirvana Meditation Center, who said, "Yeah, just send a letter and a photograph to Pune and see what happens." So Leela and I formulated a letter together, just telling a little bit about me and what I like and what I'm into, sent it off with a photograph. And then a few weeks later, a letter arrived with Osho's handwritten signature on it and above it, my name, Swami Prem Divakar, which means son of love, sunshine of love. And that's how I became a sannyasin.
Okay, and your name has a very, very beautiful meaning. So after you took sannyas, for a few years, you continued your life in London, going to school and doing everything else that kids normally do. And then you were asked by your parents, who were both sannyasin, I think, at the time, if you wanted to go to India and live with Osho. And you did exactly that for a couple of years or so. So can you tell us about your relationship with Osho as a teenager? How did you perceive him, them, when you were, you know, 15 years old?
So the experience of being in the ashram and being in that, I suppose, yes, the Buddha field, I suppose, but it was set out in such a way that you arrive in this place with thousands of people all walking around with this man's picture on their neck, hanging around on their malas, that there's pictures of him on the walls. So there starts to be a bit of, it starts to have, from a 10-year-old's perspective, it it is very much like a, it looks very much like a religion. It felt very much like this was, he was God. So I didn't have all the intellectual understanding of what enlightenment meant and the history of masters and Buddhas, and I didn't have any of that. So to me, he was just, according to, you know, my mum and all the people I'd hung out with for years already in London and in communes that we'd lived in prior to leaving to India. So it was a bit like meeting God. It was a bit like sort of meeting, it felt like I was going to meet some kind of super being for my first darshan. It literally felt like I was meeting, like, not a human being. I was meeting some kind of extraordinary being, as if it was like going to meet an alien being or something. So that was how I felt. It was very exciting, but quite scary as well, because I wasn't sure what an enlightened being is. And I kind of thought to myself, is he going to be able to read my mind? Is he going to be able to, like, look into my eyes and tell all sorts of things that he can see inside about who I am and what I'm about? And I had no idea about that. And then my first experience of Bhagwan was, the best way I can describe it was, this was the first time that I ever saw an individual with no personality. There was no person behind the eyes. That's the best way I can describe. People say to me, how did it feel sitting in front of Osho? And I said, what you felt wasn't so much what was there, what wasn't there that made it really striking. That you looked into his eyes and you could see a consciousness, but you couldn't see a person. It's the weirdest thing, and it's very difficult to describe it. But that's the best way I can describe it as a 10-year-old, is that it felt a bit like, an interesting thing just to jump forward, but when he passed away, when Osho died, and I looked at his face, both in Buddha Hall and when he was about to be cremated, and he looked exactly the same as he looked when he was meditating. And what it's kind of struck me that from both ends, that as much as when I first met him, I couldn't see this personality, when he had died, there was still no personality. Nothing had gone. Nothing had disappeared for me. It was very strange. I've not experienced that with anyone else, but that's the best way I can describe it, was this absence of personality. That's the best way I can describe it.
Well, that's fascinating to hear the experience of Osho from the eyes of a 10-year-old child. And then obviously you grew. So how did the relationship with Osho evolved in your life as you grew into your teenagers and adult life and present days?
Well, there were very clear, distinct phases. There was a phase, the early part, so being in India, arrived in India in 79, early 79, and I was 14 years old. But I was a reasonably mature 14-year-old. I wasn't, I was already sort of breaking into puberty in my early, and adolescence at that age. I was quite forward in that way. But I initially arrived and felt quite isolated. And the reason is because I had had a very structured life prior to that. I was going to school. I had homework. I had family life. I was living in a commune, a sannyas commune, but I still had to go to school. So my life was structured. And then, as you say, my parents said, do you want to go to India? And me and my sister discussed it and very quickly decided that would probably be quite fun. But landing in India, two things happened. One, I was given the opportunity, if I wanted to. In fact, at my first darshan with Osho, when he welcomed me, he said, would you like to work in the ashram? Well, he asked me how I was. I said, I'm very happy to be here. And he chuckled and he said, would you like to do some work in the ashram? And I said, is there any chance of doing some sort of groups that kids can do? Like, I wanted to do the centering group, which was apparently the only group that kids could do at the time. And he just said, no, you just work in ashram. That will be your group. That will be your therapy group. And I was like, okay. So he gave me that opportunity, and I could have at any time gone to Vidya and said, I'm ready to work. But I kind of wasn't ready to just do that. And no one was forcing me to do it. So I kind of just defaulted into taking complete control of my life as a 14-year-old for the first time, from one day to the next, going from a structured life of school, family, homework, back to school, a repetitive life, going into a situation where I was completely left to my own devices, which was wonderful in one way, but also quite scary in another way, because I had to come to that realization that actually I'm now to design my own life. My parents and my sister were working in the ashram. I was able to, if I wanted to, go and work in the ashram and make that my daily routine. Eventually I did, but first I didn't. And I was a bit isolated. I was a bit stuck. And I was also, because I'd been bullied very badly in school in the UK before going to India, I was kind of really worried that I was going to run into a bunch of other teenagers, sannyas teenagers, and I was going to have to deal with power struggles and bullying and all that stuff. So I was a bit reticent. I was a bit scared when I first arrived in India. But I basically found my way, started to make connections with people my age, and we kind of coalesced into a group of about 20 or 25 teenagers of between the ages of sort of 14 and 18, 19. And we basically were our little own network, because there was nothing formally set up in Pune for kids or teenagers. It was very much an adult-oriented experience. So my experience of Osho in that first phase in Pune 1 was, as I describe it, that I was living in this huge community of people that all had this devotion to Bhagwan. And that obviously rubbed off on the teenagers. We were part of that whole thing. We would go to celebration evenings. We would talk about how much we love Bhagwan, how amazing he is. And there was a lot of adoration and a lot of he was held in such high reverence by everyone around us. So we kind of just basically, kind of sat in that energy as well. So it was almost like there was a bit of a distance because of security, etc. In the ashram, you didn't get to, Bhagwan didn't walk around the ashram. He was alone in Lao Tzu, protected with lots of security and lots of guards. And he came out to Buddha Hall and did his thing and then went back in. So there wasn't ever an experience of a personal connection. There was always the experience that you were connected to the commune. So for that phase, I had that sort of connection. I was a sannyasin. I was amongst other young sannyasins, and I was far more focused and far more engaged and interested in the way that I was relating with people my own age. This was the big thing for me in Pune 1, leaving a conventional childhood, a conventional school child life that I was living, and suddenly arriving in India, and then the relationships, the connections, the way we communicated with my peers, with people my age, was so different to the way I'd communicated with anyone my age in my whole life. And that's what really made Pune 1, that phase, very strong for me, was the way that I was able to connect and get close and intimate and express love and friendship between people my own age in such an amazing open way, because we were in this heightened spiritual atmosphere. So we were maturing very quickly together. So that was that phase of it. And that was, as I said, from 14 to 16. And then when I left India and went actually for a period back to South Africa with my parents, Leela, because I'm Leela's son, I was around, and as I say, we have a very strong connection. Her energy was able to, in a matter of weeks, she started a center in South Africa. We found a property. Within a very short space of time, we had many people queuing up to come and be part of this commune that we created. So we did that. So I still have a very strong connection to Osho, even when he was creating the new commune in Oregon in the first years. This is 1981, 82. And then came back to the UK, and then I ended up in various centers, one of them in Bristol in the West Country of the UK. And it was there that we worked hard and saved so that we could get to the first annual World Celebration. That phase of the ranch and Rajneeshpuram was a phase that was very difficult for me, being quite rebellious in my nature. I found and experienced such a shift in the energy of the whole community. And by 1983, 84, I was like, I really don't know what's happened. This beautiful spiritual community I've been part of has turned into some kind of strange cult, and people are suffering, people are struggling, and I don't like this. And I, in essence, dropped sannyas. I no longer wish to be considered a practicing sannyasin. I dropped my orange clothes. I went and bought jeans and black T-shirts, and just somehow, if you like, I took sannyas at that point, because I let go of my conditioning and my past, which happened to be sannyas, because I grew up in it, you see. So for me to step out and get authentic with who I was as an individual, as a human being, somewhere I had to disconnect. So there was a period of disconnection. And that period of disconnection, you know, went on. A lot of nonsense happened, as you know, in Rajneeshpuram, and a lot of fallout. So a lot of people felt estranged, cut off from Osho, from the whole commune. And I was kind of like straddling that. Sometimes I had my mum, who was still totally committed, living in Pune, running the group department. My father, who was completely cynical, was no longer had any trust for Osho. And that was kind of like a spectrum, you know, of all the people I knew took various positions, and that changed things a bit. And it kind of diluted the power of the Buddha field of that community that had been there in Pune One. In the late 80s, I went back to Pune for a while, not a long time, just for a month or so. That was in 1989. Again, my mum was running the group department and I wanted to see her. So I spent a few weeks in India. It was a wonderful time. And I remember lying on Krishna House fountain listening to discourse one evening. And he was doing like the deeper deepers, like, you know, like this shouts Osho and then lies back on each other's laps. And I was just lying there relaxed, and he was speaking very softly and gently. And at one point he said, "Right now you are the most important people in the world." And something inside me sat me up like a spring just snapped inside me, and I just sat up and I thought, no, this is not working for any of me. This elitist, this idea that somehow, you know, we are special or we are elite. He may not have meant it in that context, but that's how it hit me. That's how it landed in me. And something happened where I got a bit of a separation. I suddenly thought to myself, I need to become my own Buddha. I need to stop following or thinking about Bhagwan as the source of my insight, of my growth. I need to turn in and start working for myself. And that was a very empowering moment. Again, thanks to Osho, you know, inadvertently, he basically pushed me off my crutches. So I had to stagger a bit and get onto my own two feet. So I did that. And that really settled my concerns and my upsetness about the commune and what had happened in America. And I softened to the message. You know, I got more involved at that point in reading his books. I got more involved at that point, in my own meditation practice, in my own desire to awaken. So that's, I would say, in essence, that's when my true journey really began, is in the late 80s, when I actually then, as a 20-something-year-old, took responsibility for my own life. And in that, it freed Osho's role in my life to be where it is now, which is a reminder, simply that he acts as a reminder to me. So that's how my connection, it changed and evolved and went through different phases. And it was only, as I say, about 7-8 years ago, because I've, you know, still very connected through my mother all these years that she was running and touring the Mystic Rose around the world. And of course, we were very in touch and talked about Mystic Rose a lot. I mean, over the years, I don't know how many thousands of hours we've spoken in depth about the process. And I watched it develop. I watched her grow through it. I watched her struggle through it, and got a very deep understanding from her, because she used me as a sounding board. We talked so much about the process, and eventually she said, "Would you like to come and train?" Because I'm getting to the point
Let me interrupt you for a second. We'll talk about Mystic Rose just in a moment, but you know, I just wanted to summarize what you just described, which is a beautiful journey, and it's very interesting for me to hear your point of view as a child and a teenager with Osho evolving into a mature man. And you know, the first time I hear the story from the other side, you know, because most of the sannyasins have been, you know, conditioned by Catholic religion or the Christian or the Jewish or communist, and then they go to Osho to get rid of that. And your case was more like a conditioning of being with the Bhagwan, the semi-god or the guru, and then you somehow at some point you had to free yourself from that kind of idea to find your way, which is beautiful. And I'd love to now focus on your present day. If you can describe your relationship with Osho today as a man, I think you are in your 50s, if my calculations are correct. Yeah. And then we'll jump and talk about Mystic Rose.
Okay. The only reason I mentioned the Mystic Rose is because in context of what you just asked, that's what's happened recently, is when my mum asked me to come and train to do the Mystic Rose. That reconnected me to Osho. Because even though I'd been following her in her work, I hadn't had a personal connection with Osho for many years. I was raising a family, paying a mortgage, running a business, and that was my life. So the Mystic Rose got me back to a much stronger connection with Osho. And that's the context of why I mentioned that. So in how the connection is today, is that your question? How am I connected today? Well, I'm connected through the process of the meditative therapies. That's the main way I'm connected to it. I don't have any connection to the Pune commune or any other particular commune as such. I don't do I hang out with sannyasins? Some of my friends are sannyasins, some of them aren't. So I have, you know, I have a kind of a very integrated, I suppose, connection with Osho at this time. He's a part of my life, but I wouldn't say that I live as a devotee at this time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, fair enough. You know, absolutely. So for the past 7 years, you have been running the Osho Mystic Rose with Leela, who is the creator of the process. And I interviewed Leela, as you mentioned, in episode 8. So if everyone is interested, they can go and listen to the details of the discussion. And, you know, she describes how Mystic Rose was born and how Osho donated this beautiful process to her personally.
Yes.
So you are a senior facilitator trainer.
Yes.
So what was your inspiration and motivation to get involved with the Osho Mystic Rose?
I think it's just as I just said before, over the 25 years prior to me getting involved in Mystic Rose, the 25 years that Leela was running it around the world, every time she was in Europe, we would meet up and we would be on the phone before Skype happened. So we would have a lot of in-depth discussions about the process. She would describe what it's like, what people are going through. I mean, literally, she said, we're in the third day of crying, you know, it's going really well, or this, you know, I've only got 9 people in the room, it's really struggling. So I watched the process unfold. In terms of anyone apart from Leela, I was somebody who was kept up to date about how things were going more than anyone I know, just because, you know, she needed someone to talk to about it, someone where she could bounce ideas and say this happens and that happens and just describe her different strategies and techniques of improving the process. So, so I was attracted to the process because I understand the process. And what I love about the process is its simplicity. And I was drawn to it because I'd experienced it, and I'd experienced it for myself, doing the Mystic Rose myself, going through a very difficult part of my life, you know, in separating from, you know, my family basically, you know, started to come apart, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago, and in a very difficult marriage, difficult time in my life. And Mystic Rose was an incredibly powerful tool to release, to create some space for me to make good decisions, for me to make far more intelligent decisions about how I respond, how I react, how I live my life through good times and bad times. So I was drawn to the process because there is a logical answer to this question, Swaram, and there's also an illogical answer. And the illogical answer is I don't know, but it felt right.
And that's probably Osho coming back from the back door without you knowing it. I don't know, I just felt like saying this. Okay, so in your work as a facilitator trainer, would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, I mean, as you know, Leela's been running the training for many years, and I did a first training with her in Osho Nisarga in India. I think it was 2011 or something like that. And then continued doing trainings with her in Turkey in different places around the world, and got very familiar with the training in itself. And then what I did was I took the manual, because Leela had written a training manual, quite an extensive and comprehensive manual for helping people who become facilitators, how to train them to facilitate and how to run the process effectively. And I basically just updated that. So I rewrote it, re-edited it, brought it into the 21st century because it had first been written in the early 90s. So then I have developed the training, if you like. So now the last training I did was in Corfu, which was running concurrently to the Mystic Rose that we were running there. So we had a big training with about 15 people for that training. And a lot of the training is because of the way the Mystic Rose is structured, most of the training is built around how we build context and information, how we give information, how we do the introductions, the introduction to the different phases of the process. That's the main body of the training. so that people really, because once the process starts, as you know, there's no talking, nothing, there's nothing more to be said. So everything revolves around presenting the process properly to people so that they really understand what's going on, what they can look out for, and what the intention is behind the process, what it's, how it works and why it works. So explaining that to people gives them the tools and the support and the knowledge they need to face the difficulties and the resistance that come up in experiencing the process. So that's the trick. And then I also extended the training into a more practical side, which is where I express and train people in managing, creating, managing, and running an event, because being a facilitator is a one small part of running a Mystic Rose. You do have to facilitate the process, but you also have to be a group leader as well as a facilitator. So you have to handle the practicalities of dealing with a group of 30, 40, 50 people. You also have to understand the logistics of how everything works, whether it's people's accommodation, people's food, bringing them in, you know, scheduling, creating schedules, the logistics of the room, how the room should be set up. So there's a lot of training on that side of it, on logistics. Then there's a whole another section of training on marketing yourself, so that you, how do you build a crowd? How do you actually fill a three-week process? So there's the marketing, the promotion, the build, the how you build a crowd, how that works through social media, how that works through your networks, and how to approach that. So it's a very, it's now become a much more broad, and I would say probably a more comprehensive and complete training.
Yeah, it sounds like a perfect complement to the work of Lila, because I believe, you know, she puts all the skills and expertise, and then, you know, probably she was missing this aspect that you, this element that you bring, which is great. So,
well, the thing is, you see, a lot of people trained, a lot of people, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people have done the training with Lila, and currently there might be at most half a dozen, maybe eight people running the process around the world. All right, so that is the reality of that is because it's difficult to get commitment, to get people to come to a 21-day process. It's expensive for people. They have to take the time off work. So there was a sense that the training, that you can train and train and train people, but if people don't have the capacity to understand the logistics, to understand promotion, to understand marketing, to understand that they're starting a business, never mind that they're facilitating a group. See, Lila didn't have to do that because she was in Pune. So the people were queuing up at the door. Hundreds of people wanted to do the process. And she was running two a day sometimes. I'm sure she mentioned that to you. She was doing crying in the morning, laughing in the afternoon. And she didn't have to at any point in the early stages find ways to fill groups. That became more apparent when she was traveling around the world and she had to make that effort to actually fill the groups. So in my experience of trying to put on events, which I have some, and trying to run other Mystic Roses or shorter versions or other types of processes, finding venues, facilitating, that is very easy. It's not easy, but it's easy compared to getting bums on seats, to getting people committed to their own process, to getting people to make that commitment to their own growth to the extent that they will take 3 weeks off work to come and do this crazy process. So that is you're right to say that focus needed to be shifted away from just facilitation, because when Lila was doing the training, it was mainly we'd work through the manual and we would practice and she would give people context and understanding, but she would also just talk a lot about the process, talk a lot about what Osho had said to her about the process, so that people understood from the horse's mouth, directly from Osho, how mm-hmm. the process, why the process worked.
Yeah, and I think I just want to reiterate that Lila is the original person who received this gift from Osho to create and facilitate Osho Mystic Rose. And so if everyone is interested in getting a training, there is no better place and person to go than Lila and yourself, of course, that you are helping her in the process. So I understand you're also in the middle of writing a couple of books, and one I believe is on Mystic Rose. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So Lila's been in the process of writing the book about the story of the Mystic Rose and her experience of it, how it came to be, her journey with it through the last 30 years and where it is now. And she has made several attempts to really take a good bite into that project. But due to her other commitments and just due to her not having written a book before and perhaps not being something that she has that much of a kind of a drive or interest to do, she knows the book needs to be written. So she's basically asked me, she said, can we co-write the book? And I will sort of manage the process. I'll interview her. And we will go. I mean, I know the story, but I want, you know, I want the book to be her voice and her story, but I will create the book. I'll write it. I will structure it. I will edit it. I will put together a manuscript and we will get it published. So that's that project, which is in the very early stages now. We're just in the fundamental storyboarding and structuring. So we're just building the skeleton, but we will be doing it over 2019 and look to have that, ready by the end of next year.
Sounds amazing. Love it. Can't wait to see it completed. So what are you up to in addition to this, if anything else?
I am writing a biographical novel. So it's a story, but it's based on my experiences as a 14, 15, and 16-year-old living in India in 79 to 81. So it's the 3 years I was in India. It revolves some around the ashram and around Osho and my experiences with the ashram. But it also has a lot to do with my experiences in Pune with this huge bunch of crazy people, this 5,000-6,000 people all living together in Pune. So there was a whole world of communities, sub-communities, collections of people living in villages, tented villages, bamboo hut villages on the riverbanks. You know, there was all the Japanese lived in one place and all the Germans lived somewhere else. And so huge groups of people took over these beautiful big colonial houses all over Corrigan Park and the surrounding areas and created these massive communities, some with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people living in them, sannyasins living in them. And I was just in that world. So I had one foot in the ashram, which was kind of very clean and good and working and meditating, and that was all there. But at the same time, I had another foot in this underbelly, this kind of bunch of people that were connected to Goa and Ibiza and parties. So there was an incredible social scene outside of the ashram. Very, very vibrant, lively, I have to say, quite debauched scene, of which I drank my fill. It was a very powerful, very enchanted time. So that a lot of my experience of the book comes out of that, taking quite a lot of psychedelic drugs, the whole reality of coming to my sexuality and experiencing all these different women and these different experiences. And bear in mind, I was a youngster, huh? So it was all coming at me at the same time, the spirituality, the psychedelia, the sexuality. So this book is, someone asked me actually when I was writing, because I went to India in February and I was sitting and writing, and this other person who noticed me writing saying, really, you've got a whole, you can write a whole book from just 3 years? And I said to her, I said, I could write a trilogy about those 3 years. I said, I'm having to choose from the thousands of extremely unbelievable events that happened to me in those 3 years so that I can fit something into a book, because there's so much more that happened than I could ever put into one story. The point I'm making is that there was so much happening that it was such an intense and vibrant experience. So that's what that book is about. It's basically about me moving from being a very timid, bullied young kid in the UK, going to school and do my thing, and how I was, what I turned into by the time I left India in 1981, what a transformation had occurred in me, what a change had occurred through these experiences, some of them very scary. I mean, I was close to losing my life quite often in India. I found myself in extremely dangerous situations, where one of them is this chapter about where I had to escape from Goa because I would have been killed by a gang head on, because I crashed the motorbike, I didn't have the money, and this guy very calmly came and sat with me in Lily's chai shop in Shapura Beach, and he just got out this huge knife and he just stuck it in the desk and twiddled the top of his knife around. He looked at me and he said, look, I understand your situation, but if I have to come back here tomorrow, it's not going to be a good thing. It's not going to be a good thing. So that night I got on the back of a roof rack of a Jeep, got taken to Mups. I slept in the bus station and got the 6 a.m. train, the 6 a.m. bus back to Pune the next morning. And if I hadn't managed to get out of Goa, I would have been in very serious trouble. So this story has has everything. It's got, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, spirituality, and all kinds of stuff. So that's the other book I'm writing at the moment.
That's beautiful. Live life dangerously. And probably a dream of many teenagers to do all that kind of experimentation and adventures. Okay, so Divakar, we are heading towards the end. I've got three final questions for you. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Well, it's different. I don't have a kind of fixed routine. If I'm not got any immediate work on, I will have quite a nice slow start, actually. So, you know, I'm quite politically active. I look at, you know, I'm quite interested in what's going on in my country at the moment. So I'm quite engaged and involved in that. So, you know, I'm reading the news. I'm writing blogs, responding to comments, responding to people's response to my comments. What else do I do? I do something in the morning called, I don't know if you know about Ho'oponopono. It's just a ritual that I do that is based on Huna, which is Hawaiian shamanism. And it's just a very beautiful ritual to do in the morning where you just sit and whatever particular subject is needing some love and some care and some attention. It basically involves just incantations that, you know, where you forgive yourself, you show blessings to yourself, you express gratitude to yourself or to people that may have hurt you. So it's a very cleansing, healing process that, and that's something that I like to do every morning. And then I like to do a bit of stretching. I wouldn't say I do yoga, but I do some very deep stretches, which is great. Maybe a little dance, I put on my favorite bit of music and have a little move around in my room like a crazy person. And then get on with whatever needs to happen in my day. But sometimes I have to go out early to meetings. Other times I have to be somewhere. Other times I have quite a flexible life. I don't have a very structured routine in that way. I have a few different kinds of routines.
Okay. So the second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Nada Brahma is my favorite meditation. Why is it my favorite meditation? Because it makes me feel wonderful. I don't know. I mean, it's a funny thing to say because different meditations make me feel different. So for me to compare, say, Nada Brahma to Dynamic, it's for me, it's like apples and pears. I couldn't say that I prefer Nada Brahma to Dynamic because Dynamic does what Dynamic does and Nada Brahma does what Nada Brahma does. But I will say this, I enjoy meditating at sunset and Nada Brahma is the sunset meditation. And I love humming. I love using my voice in that way. And I don't know, just for me, it's my favorite meditation because I like doing it most. I don't know how else to say it. That's it.
No, that's more than enough. Wonderful. It gives the flavor of it. So the last question is, you have been with Osho since childhood. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2018?
I feel very proud to have Osho in my life. I feel very blessed I feel very blessed by my background. I feel very blessed by the way life has offered me such a unique opportunity. And I also feel that my connection to Osho now as a 50 something person, you know, with the mentality and the understanding and also the open minded, open heartedness that has returned to my connection with him is that I feel very strongly that my connection is multi life. In other words, there was an inevitability about him coming into my life. That's how it feels. And in a way, you know, there have been a lot of times when I felt very tested about being a sannyasin. I've had people call on it. You know, when you have a lot of non-sannyasin friends, you often have to go through the same conversation. You know, what is surrender? Why this person isn't this just a cult? Why if he preaches individualism, why would you follow someone who preaches that? Surely that's a contradiction. I've reached a very serene place with all of that. I don't want to try and figure out why I'm a sannyasin. I don't want to try and figure out why I feel the love for Osho that I do. I don't even want to try and figure out how to become enlightened. I have no desire to become enlightened. That is not an aspiration for me. My aspiration is to wake up in the morning and feel excited about being alive. That will do me. And the tools that Osho has given me over my lifetime have facilitated and helped me to reach that experience in my life. And my gratitude to him for that is complete.
Well, that's beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Divakar. So that's the end of the show. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed listening to your story. And I so look forward to reading your books, both the one on Misty Crows and the other one on your story as a teenager in Pune. I'm sure it's full of very funny and less funny, perhaps. Stories. So sending you lots of love, a big hug, and thank you again.
Okay. If people would like to read any of my articles, they can go to, my legal name is Mark Itzler, and they can just go to markitzler.com, and that's my website, which is articles that have been in OSHA News and OSHA Times, but people can read them there too.
Oh, that's great. Yes. Oh, sure. And I will link your website to the note show. So if everyone is interested, they can just click that and find you.
Cool. Thanks, Varun.
Thank you. Lots of love. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Love Out Show podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit loveoutshow.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.